From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Pakistan is on the brink of disaster, writes Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's best known in the U.S. for his best-selling book, Taliban. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Rashid about the upcoming presidential election in Pakistan and what it means for the war on terrorism. The Bush administration supports President Pervez Musharraf, who also controls the military. Musharraf is opposed by people who want a more democratic government in Pakistan, and he's opposed by extremists. According to an Islamist website, Osama bin Laden has just declared war against Musharraf. Also, critic Milo Miles reviews a new DVD set of classic Popeye the Sailor cartoons produced by the Fleischer Brothers Studios in the 1930s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pakistan is on the brink of disaster, writes my guest Ahmed Rashid. He is a Pakistani journalist who has written extensively about Islamic extremism and is the author of the best-selling book Taliban. He's contributed to the Washington Post and the Daily Telegraph of London. Rashid says after 8 years as president, General Pervez Musharraf is unable to keep the peace at home or root out Islamic extremists along the border with Afghanistan. Musharraf took power in a 1999 coup. Now he's running for president in an election by the National Assembly, which has just been scheduled for October 6th. Musharraf is not only president, he's the head of the army. But he's just made the promise that if he wins the election, he'll step down from the military. He's opposed by people in Pakistan who are calling for a more democratic government. He's also opposed by extremists. A new Al-Qaeda video condemns the military for its assault on Islamic militants who took over the Red Mosque in Islamabad over the summer. And in a new recording on an Islamist website, bin Laden has declared war on Musharraf. Ahmed Rashid, welcome back to Fresh Air. Before we get into talking about the Pakistan elections, just I'd like to start with, since it's mostly Americans listening to our show, what do Americans have at stake in this election?
Well, I think there's an enormous amount at stake here. Pakistan is the only nuclear power in the Muslim world. It is on the front line against Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda leadership are now believed by American intelligence to be in Pakistan rather than in Afghanistan. There's the whole issue of democracy and the promises by the Bush administration that they would support democracy in the Muslim world. And Pakistan is critical to the Middle East, to the Arab nations. It has a long-running conflict with India, and nobody wants that to erupt again. So all in all, there's a great deal at stake.
Well, let's get to the latest news about the election. It's going to be held October 6th. And a few days ago, President Musharraf said that if he's elected as president, that he would step down as head of the military. Would you interpret what's going on with that?
Well, Musharraf said that he will stand for president, another five-year term as president, on October the 6th, but he will stand in uniform. That is, he will stand as army chief. Now, that has resulted in a huge furore from the opposition, who've said that he should take off his uniform before he stands and stand as a civilian president, which he's refusing to do. And the opposition have said that they may boycott the proceedings, they may even resign their seats, and they may launch a street movement against him. Now, all this poses enormous risk to him. He has one card to play, which is that he could declare martial law. And in fact, some of his ministers have been threatening that over the last 24 hours. The other issue at stake is that there are several petitions in the Supreme Court, which is now hearing these petitions. And these petitions are demanding that Musharraf take off his uniform before he stands for president. Now, if the Supreme Court rules in the next few days that he has to take off his uniform, that will prompt another crisis, because either Musharraf then agrees with the Supreme Court and takes off his uniform, or again, he declares martial law and dismisses the Supreme Court altogether.
Why does he want to stay in uniform? Why does he want to stay the head of the military until he's elected?
Well, I think it's all a question of power and clout and prestige. The fact is that he's been army chief for the last 8 years. And given that he is now so unpopular, he commands very little loyalty in the country from any of the political forces. It's incredibly important for him to be seen as all powerful and as army chief while he stands for president, because in a sense, that is what he's going to use to cower the opposition and even those who are going to vote for him.
So as long as he's the head of the military, he can declare basically martial law and then do what he pleases. So he can change the outcome of the election as long as he's in uniform?
Well, you know, if he declares martial law, it would just be a terrible downward slide because, you know, after 8 years of being in power, the fact that an army general has to go back or revert back to imposing martial law, it would be a setback to democracy. It would lead to a furor in the streets, in parliament, and even amongst the international community. I think the Americans would find it very difficult to continue supporting Musharraf if he ruled in a martial law regime. So I think, you know, he would like to avoid that, but at the same time, he would like a smooth passage to his presidency. Now, what the opposition is saying is basically that, Mr. Musharraf, you are blackmailing us and the nation. What you are actually saying is, elect me as president, and then I will drop the uniform. And that is being seen by the media, by the opposition, as blackmail, as a threat.
So, you know, he's the head of the military. Does the military support him?
Well, it's very uncertain exactly, you know, where the military stands right now. The military has been in the front line against Al-Qaeda along the Afghan border. It's been taking very high casualties. There have been large-scale desertions in the military on the border. And certainly his generals are supporting him. But all the indications are that I think there's growing resentment in the rank and file of the army, the soldiers, some of whom have been influenced by the extremists and extremist Islamic propaganda, and some of them who are just kind of fed up of being the target of abuse by a public which is increasingly fed up with the military and the army. Every day in the media, every day on TV, you're getting politicians heaping abuse at the army. And I think, you know, some of those professional junior officers, soldiers, would like to see the army go back to the barracks and get out of the limelight.
Well, you say that, you know, hundreds of Pakistani soldiers recently surrendered to the Taliban without firing a shot, that soldiers in that Badlands territory between Pakistan and Afghanistan, where there's a lot of Al-Qaeda and Taliban, soldiers there are sometimes refusing to open fire on extremists. Is this because they're sympathizing with them or because they're afraid? What's going on?
I think it's a mixture of things. First of all, the Pakistan Army has been deployed in these tribal areas for the last 4 years, and they have utterly failed to subdue the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And in fact, what we're seeing is an expansion of the Pakistani Taliban, expanding right across the tribal areas and now into what we call the settled areas of the Northwest Frontier Province. So in a sense, the army has really failed. Secondly, a lot of the army up there, and especially the paramilitary forces, are Pashtuns. That is, they belong to the same ethnic group and often the same tribes who are living up there. And they are very loath to fire and kill their fellow Pashtuns. And thirdly, I think the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have been using really extreme terrorist tactics. I mean, we've seen, you know, soldiers' bodies have come back which have been mutilated, their tongues have been chopped off, their heads have been chopped off. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda are using frightening techniques which are literally not only terrorizing the civilian population, but also terrorizing the army.
So the United States has been supporting Musharraf in the hopes that Musharraf will keep the lid on the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And of course, he'd be doing that through the military, but the military is failing to do that. But the Bush administration is still supporting Musharraf.
Well, I think, you know, this is one of the really enormous mistakes, which is going to have very big repercussions down the road. The Bush administration is supporting Musharraf 110% and has shown little inclination to back the movement by the Democratic parties, the movement by the lawyers and the Supreme Court to bring about the rule of law and constitutional rule. And this has led to enormous anti-Americanism. There was already, of course, a great deal of anti-Americanism in Pakistan because of sympathies for the Islamic forces and even bin Laden. But right now, you've got people in the middle class, you've got professional people, lawyers, engineers, doctors, who just see the Americans as backing a military dictatorship when alternatives have now emerged. That is, elections, the Supreme Court becoming so active in trying to decipher the law, war, and the Americans are seeing as they were 30, 40 years ago during the Cold War as backing military dictator, especially when Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been pushing for democratization in the Arab world and other parts of the Muslim world. Here is a case of a country, you know, yearning for democracy, and the Americans are backing the dictator. So I think this is leading to enormous frustration and anger, which is not doing the Bush administration any good.
What is the Supreme Court's role in this upcoming election? What's the movement that they are leading now?
Well, a bit of history here. You know, we've had four martial laws in Pakistan, and traditionally the Supreme Court has been very pliant, and it has always condoned military rule. It has never opposed military rule. Now, for the first time, you have a very activist Supreme Court, which started off opposing actions by the military, for example, demanding that the military reveal how many prisoners it was holding in its secret jails, much like the CIA has been holding these disappeared prisoners. And this kind of activism annoyed President Musharraf greatly. He then decided to suspend the Chief Justice, thinking that, you know, the Chief Justice Iftikhar Chaudhry would just kind of go away quietly. Instead, what happened, there was a huge reaction amongst the lawyers and the judiciary, and a movement was launched for 4 months. Lawyers took to the streets. They boycotted the courts. All legal work came to a standstill, and until a panel of the Supreme Court reinstated the Chief Justice. Now, once that happened, it is clear that there's a complete standoff between Musharraf and the Chief Justice right now. And of course, this panel of the Supreme Court hearing whether Musharraf should stay in uniform or take off his uniform before elections is riveting the nation right now, because if the Supreme Court rules against Musharraf, then of course he could well then reimpose some kind of military rule.
There's no way you think he's going to back down?
Well, I think it'll be very difficult for him to back down, because he has said one thing. If he's seen to back down, it may well affect his election. Even those who are willing to vote for him would say he's now too weak, too unpopular to be voted in as president.
My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's reported extensively on Islamic extremism in his books and newspaper articles. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is journalist Ahmed Rashid. He lives in Pakistan and has been reporting from Pakistan and from the larger region for many years. He's the author of the best-selling book, Taliban, and also contributes to the Washington Post and the Daily Telegraph of London. We're talking about the upcoming elections in Pakistan, what's at stake in Pakistan, and also what's at stake for the United States. Musharraf has a couple of strong members of the opposition who want to run for prime minister, both of whom have been living in exile. One of them, Nawaz Sharif, is the person who Musharraf deposed in the 1999 bloodless coup. Sharif returned to Pakistan, and hours later, Musharraf forced him back into exile, even though the Supreme Court said that Sharif could stay. Let's look at Sharif for a second. What does his party represent?
Well, Sharif is basically popular in the largest province of the country, Punjab, which has something like 60% of the population, and most significantly, 80% of the army is recruited from the Punjab. He represents really, if you like, middle class business interests. But his regime, he was prime minister twice in the 1990s, and like Benazir Bhutto, who was also prime minister twice, his governments were repeatedly accused of corruption and incompetence. But nevertheless, his years in exile, the fact that he took the bold decision to come back and then to be deported again, all this has raised his image enormously in Pakistan. And he's a very serious political contender now for prime ministership, if he's allowed to contest.
Now, former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto is planning to return in mid-October to run for prime minister. She's not on good terms with Musharraf, but he apparently will allow her to come back. What does she stand for politically?
Well, historically, the Pakistan People's Party, which she leads, has been the party which has been anti-army and anti-mullah. They are very much against extremism and very much against continued military rule. And they are by far, I think, the largest and most popular national political party in the country. We should remember Pakistan has four provinces, and a lot of the politics in Pakistan is regional and ethnic-based rather than on a national level. So Bhutto represents that, but her two governments in the 1990s were also accused of widespread corruption and incompetence. Her husband has been under a cloud ever since. She and her husband have faced numerous corruption charges, which are still pending. Now, the controversy around Benazir Bhutto has been that over the last 6 months or so, she has been pushed by the Americans and by the British to work out a deal with Musharraf, in the sense that Musharraf would allow her to come back. She would contest the elections. And if elected, she would work with Musharraf against extremism.
Let me quote something that you recently wrote. You wrote, "The West is desperate to bring Benazir Bhutto and Pervez Musharraf into a loveless marriage so the general can combat terrorists and the lady can play democracy." Very skeptical.
Yes, well, I mean, it's skeptical because, frankly, her own party is very skeptical and has been very cynical of her response, because her own party, its roots lie in anti-militarism, and they don't want to see their party, linking up with the military and becoming a partner of Musharraf. So what she risks doing, if there is such a deal, and so far no deal has been cemented, what she risks doing is actually alienating her own vote bank, which could mean that she may not get the kind of votes she's hoping to get. So it's a very difficult balancing act that she has to play.
So tell us a little bit more about the alliance you think the West wants to create between Musharraf and Bhutto, and what role the West is willing to play to try to create that alliance.
Well, ideally, I think, what the Americans and the British were hoping for about 2 years ago was that this upcoming election right now would be a kind of transition where Musharraf would genuinely surrender some of his powers to a more powerful parliament and civilian prime minister. And the war on extremism and terrorism could then be run with a former army chief as president and a bunch of politicians working closely with him. Now, the problem here has been twofold. First, on the Musharraf side, he's shown no inclination to give up any power to parliament or a newly elected prime minister. And that's been partly why the deal with Bhutto has not been done, because he's refused to give up any power. And Bhutto's demanding that, look, for my own credibility within my own party, within the country, you have to be seen to be giving up some of your powers. So Musharraf has not been willing to do that. And on the other hand, what she has been expecting is that the government end all the various corruption cases against her. Now, the army is actually saying, no, we'll suspend them, but we won't end them. In a way, the army is saying to her, we will keep these corruption cases hanging over your head so that if you don't behave, we can bring them back again, as it were. So she's not agreeing to that part of the deal either. And she has also, of course, been backtracking, because she's seen the very strong anti-army feeling that is in the country and in her party.
So what do you think the odds are that everyone in this upcoming Pakistan election will play by the rules and respect the outcome?
Well, Terry, this has been actually one of the main demands of the opposition and the media. What people have said is that a long time ago, Musharraf should have attempted some kind of national reconciliation. He should have perhaps called a round table conference. He should have invited back all the politicians in exile and released all the political prisoners and attempted a genuine national reconciliation on the grounds that what is needed is a national unity to combat extremism and terrorism. Now, if he'd done this 6 months ago or even 3 months ago, I think he would not be in such a mess as he is in now. The fact is that, you know, his actions over the last few months have really created such enormous mistrust. Nobody believes him. Nobody believes what he promises. Even today when he says that, elect me as president and then I'll drop my uniform. The fact of the matter is the media is sceptical, the opposition is sceptical, nobody believes what he's saying. So I think not all of the problems, but a lot of the problems could have been resolved if he had been magnanimous, if he'd been less stubborn, less egotistical, less arrogant, if he had been more of a kind of, if he'd been more humble and perhaps more humiliated by the fact that he had now become so unpopular, and if he'd reached out to the political parties and said to them, come, let's talk, let's set the rules of the game for the next election, and we should be able to work out something. That is not the case. There are no rules of the game, and there's you're very right, there's every likelihood that one side or the other is not going to respect any rule of the game.
Ahmed Rashid is a journalist based in Pakistan. He's contributed to the Washington Post and the Daily Telegraph of London and is the author of the bestseller Taliban. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Lord John and the Brotherhood of the Blade by Diana Gabaldon, author of the Outlander novels. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a DVD box set of classic Popeye the Sailor cartoons from the 1930s. And we continue our conversation with journalist Ahmed Rashid about the upcoming elections in Pakistan. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Ahmed Rashid, who's based in Pakistan and has reported extensively on Islamic extremism. Rashid is best known in the U.S. for his best-selling book, Taliban. We're talking about the upcoming presidential election in Pakistan and what's at stake for Pakistan and for the U.S. in the war on terrorism. The election is scheduled for October 6th and will be followed by elections for parliament and prime minister. General Pervez Musharraf, the president and head of the military, is running for re-election. Well, we've talked a little bit about Musharraf, the opposition, the Supreme Court, and the military. Let's look at the extremists for a second, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. What role might they play in the upcoming election?
Well, clearly a very strong disruptionist role. I mean, I think the Al-Qaeda and what are now called the Pakistani Taliban, that is those Taliban who are on the Pakistan side of the border, are really looking now to try and expand their base areas, to be able to bring more people under their control, under their rule. And they're expanding from the mountains now into the towns and villages that make up the Northwest Frontier Province, which borders Afghanistan. Now, this is proving to be extremely dangerous because, first of all, Musharraf and the army are far too busy with the political crisis in Islamabad to perhaps be giving the necessary attention to what is happening on the border. And what we're seeing is hundreds, if not thousands, of armed Taliban are going into towns and villages, burning video shops, imposing the veil on girls, forcing people to go to the mosque five times a day. In other words, imposing the same kind of regime that the Taliban in Afghanistan imposed back in 1994-95. So now what this is leading to, of course, is that it's terrifying people. I mean, many people who have been opposing the Taliban have been shot. That includes tribal elders who have been executed by the Taliban for daring to oppose the Taliban. Or, you know, ordinary people, school teachers, shopkeepers, people who've got things at stake have actually had to flee their towns and villages and gone to the larger cities outside the region.
Well, this is some election. I mean, on the one hand, you have a Musharraf's implicit threat of martial law if he doesn't get his way. On the other hand, legislators in the parliamentary elections are being threatened by Al-Qaeda and the Taliban that they'll be killed if they vote for Musharraf.
Well, absolutely. And many people are very skeptical as to how Pakistan is going to be able to have a general election in 3 or 4 months' time. Now, the presidential election on October 6th, that is Musharraf's election, will be carried out by the National Assembly, the main parliament, and the 4 provincial assemblies. So that's just a question of about 1,500 legislators voting for Musharraf or not voting for him. But a general election, that is a parliamentary election, which has to be carried out by January of 2008 and could well take place in December, would have to be nationwide. And there would have to be a campaign. All the parties would be able to campaign in it. And in fact, Benazir Bhutto, who has now said that she will come back in the middle of October, has ordered an armored limousine from Mercedes-Benz to precede her. She's very worried that she will be assassinated or that there will be attempts to assassinate her by the extremists.
Let me read something that you wrote. You wrote, after September 11th, the U.S. made a deal with the Musharraf regime, which had been the Taliban's main patron. And the deal was ignore Musharraf's despotism in return for his promises to crack down on Al-Qaeda and cut loose the Taliban. But that bargain is in tatters. In what sense is that bargain in tatters now?
Well, I mean, what we are seeing right now in the tribal areas on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, the fact is that the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have expanded their influence, their areas of operation, you know, since 9/11, rather than be reduced. Although initially Pakistan did capture many Al-Qaeda leaders, no significant Al-Qaeda leader has been caught for the last 3 years. Osama bin Laden is believed to be living obviously quite at ease on the Pakistan side of the border, as is his number two. Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, is also believed to be in Pakistan. So I think, you know, there's been enormous frustration by the Afghans, by the American military based in Afghanistan, and now increasingly in Washington also, at the military's inability to really rein in al-Qaeda. And I think the reason simply is that the although there have been, you know, 70, 80,000 troops, according to the army, based in the tribal areas, they haven't really been taking the offensive. And they haven't in the past 2 or 3 years been going up against, you know, launching attacks, putting commandos and special forces, etc., up against the al-Qaeda strongholds. And that has resulted in people in Washington now saying, well, if you won't do the job, then let us Americans come in and do the job. Now, that, of course, would be extremely dangerous to my mind, because if the Americans really carry out, for example, carpet bombing of al-Qaeda strongholds or in the Pakistan part of the tribal areas, or actually invade, or, you know, send in special forces or something like that, I think there would be a huge upturn in anti-Americanism right across Pakistan. And, of course, it would inflame the tribesmen.
Is there a belief that Musharraf's opposition could do a better job than Musharraf at fighting back against the Taliban and al-Qaeda?
Well, I think clearly not. I mean, first of all, many people are disillusioned that the only two major opposition choices that Pakistanis have are two, you know, failed prime ministers, as it were, and two prime ministers who were both charged with corruption. Now, but what I think, you know, people were hoping before this present political crisis erupted was that there would be some kind of partnership between the military and civilians. You know, something that you quoted me writing before, that the politicians would look after the domestic situation, they would carry out, you know, development and the economy and all the rest of it, and the military would be in partnership with the civilian government in opposing and fighting extremism and terrorism, you know, along the borders. Now, such a partnership hasn't happened before. In the 90s, for example, where there were four civilian governments, one after another, each time the army threw out the elected prime minister and his or her government. That happened to Benazir Bhutto twice and to Nawaz Sharif twice. And there was a complete lack of trust between the politicians and the army. What we are asking for now is that the army and the politicians strike up a trust and work together in order to combat extremism. Is that likely to happen? Well, it's still very much, I think, the top, you know, unanswered question. And only a free and fair election is going to demonstrate that. Will the army respect and carry out a free and fair election and then work with the newly elected prime minister?
You know, getting back to the Bush administration, you say that Vice President Cheney has always been close to Musharraf. How did they get close?
Well, I think, you know, Vice President Cheney has always been a very hardline supporter of the war on terrorism. And I think for a very long time, he interpreted Musharraf's actions with far more sympathy than perhaps other people did in the Bush administration. I think what we have seen also is that a lot of the war on terrorism and the relationship with these leaders who are frontline, President Karzai of Afghanistan, Musharraf in Pakistan, President Islam Karimov in Uzbekistan, and a lot of the Arabs, the real personal relationship has not been between Bush and these leaders, but has been between Cheney and these leaders. And it's Cheney's aides who've set up a sort of mini State Department in the vice president's office. They've been running a lot of the policies related to the war on terror and dealing with these leaders in the Muslim world who are allied to America.
It's been reported that bin Laden has threatened to wage war on Musharraf and the Pakistan army. What do you know about that, and how do you interpret it?
Well, I think, you know, certainly Bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, his number two, they had tried to assassinate Musharraf back in 2004. And ever since then, they have, in many of their statements, you know, been declaring war against Musharraf. Now, of course, what is happening in the tribal areas and this huge expansion of influence by the Pakistani Taliban is obviously encouraged Al-Qaeda enormously, and it's probably led to this kind of statement coming, you know, alongside the threats being issued by the Pakistani Taliban. Now we have a, you know, major threat by Al-Qaeda also, that they will stand by the Taliban and fight the army and obviously try and destabilize Pakistan. Clearly what Al-Qaeda wants is just as it wants in Iraq. It wants a very highly destabilized polity and country, a people who are in fear, a people where no a political government can succeed, because only then can Al-Qaeda expand its influence.
My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's reported extensively on Islamic extremism in his books and newspaper articles. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's best known in the U.S. for his best-selling book, Taliban. He's written extensively about Islamic extremism. How do you think the war in Iraq is affecting the strength of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the region between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where a lot of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda live now, have their bases, and are training people?
Well, I think the war in Iraq is having a huge impact. I mean, first of all, the fact that American military power is seen to be on the verge of some kind of withdrawal or even defeat, according to Al-Qaeda, has been an enormous encouragement to both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But secondly, now, of course, there is enormous traffic between Iraq and the Taliban. What we've seen over the last couple of years is that Taliban command have been traveling to Iraq. They've been training there. They've been learning new techniques, especially all the new techniques of roadside bombings and putting together explosives, which the Iraqi Al-Qaeda have been using against the Americans. And they've been bringing back these techniques to Afghanistan. And what we've seen, of course, is much more sophisticated Taliban attacks in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. Secondly, we've seen the escalation in suicide bombings. Now, this was something that was unheard of in Afghanistan just 3 years ago. We're seeing perhaps three or four suicide bombings a week in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So this too has been imported, if you like. And secondly, now there seems to be a lot of traffic of Arabs and Africans traveling between Iraq and Afghanistan, obviously carrying messages and perhaps money and information between Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And the same trail has also been used by Europeans. We had this extraordinary capture by German police a week ago of something like six extremists. And the Germans then said that 11 Germans had been training in Pakistan with Al-Qaeda. Now, part of that, the Germans can access Pakistan quite easily by linking up with the Pakistani extremists living in Germany, who would then redirect them to mosques and madrasas, that is religious schools in Pakistan. But another trail actually leads through Iraq, because you have had Europeans traveling to Iraq to become suicide bombers, and some of them are then diverted to Afghanistan. So what we're seeing now is this, not just separate actions by Al-Qaeda, but this enormous web of links and communication and money and training and equipment and explosives, which is taking place, all much more than ever existed before 9/11.
You talked earlier about how the Pakistani Taliban are extending their reach beyond that no man's land border region into the towns of Pakistan in the northwest region. And that they're threatening men who don't have long beards, they're threatening women, they're burning down stores that sell DVDs and stuff like that. What about in big cities like where you live? Do you feel the influence of the Taliban there?
Well, I live in Punjab, which is quite far away. But certainly what we're seeing is we're seeing not these kinds of terror tactics in the big cities, but we're seeing much greater Islamization. So, for example, what is happening is that students in colleges and universities are demanding that the girls go, that the girl students go around fully veiled. We are seeing if girls try and come out in jeans and, you know, short tops, we're seeing Islamic students perhaps hurling bottles at their cars or trying to stop them. So there is, if you like, not quite the kind of terror tactics that are being used by the Taliban in the border regions, but there's much greater fear, I think, in the cities than there was perhaps 2 or 3 years ago, and certainly much greater fear than existed in Pakistani cities before 9/11. So there has been an impact.
If you were advising the Bush administration, what would you tell the Bush administration to do?
Well, I think, I think the Bush administration have to be much more forceful in publicly insisting that Musharraf not impose martial law, that the rule of law is sustained, the rulings of the Supreme Court, that he works out some kind of national reconciliation with the opposition. He brings back the opposition leaders back into the country, holds some kind of roundtable conference or some kind of meetings with them, sets down some kind of rules of the game so that free and fair elections can be held. It's not good enough. I mean, all the Bush administration is saying, we want free and fair elections. Well, fine. I mean, so does everyone want free and fair elections. But, you know, how do you get there? First of all, how do you convince Musharraf to have free and fair elections? After all, here's a leader who rigged the 2002 elections. He's just thrown out one of the main contenders for the elections, Nawaz Sharif. And there's very little indication that he will hold a free and fair election. So I think, you know, it's terribly important that the West, the Americans, the Europeans set down some kind of line, draw a line in the sand and say, you know, there has to be, you know, we want stability, we will support stability, but the army has to do certain things.
It sounds to me like you're really worried about your country, that this kind of goes way beyond journalism.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, most Pakistanis are. I mean, I think, you know, what people are saying is that this is by far the worst political crisis that Pakistan has been through in 60 years. And that includes the war in 1971 when East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, separated from West Pakistan, which was considered, you know, obviously a trauma for the whole country. This crisis is far worse because the implications are just staggering. You asked right at the beginning, I mean, you know, why is this important for America? Well, why is this important for Pakistanis? Because, frankly, I mean, so much is at stake. We don't want to go down the road of Iraq. We don't want to go down the road of Afghanistan under the Taliban. There are so many other fissures and polarities in society right now. There's the ethnic question. There's enormous gulf between rich and poor. There's an enormous gulf between the provinces, anti-Punjab feeling. There are just so many fissures in society right now. And what people are despairing of is, can any leader, future leader, really heal the rifts that have emerged? Clearly, Musharraf has failed to do so. Can a future leader heal the rifts?
Ahmed Rashid, thank you so much for talking with us again.
Thank you very much indeed.
Ahmed Rashid is a journalist based in Pakistan. His books include Taliban and Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. Coming up, classic Popeye cartoons from the 1930s have been released on DVD, and critic Marlo Miles has a review. This is Fresh Air. In the 1930s, the Disney Studios had only one serious animation competitor, the Fleischer Brothers Studio in New York. The Fleischers had already established a hit character with Betty Boop when they licensed a superstar from newspaper comics. Back in 1929, E.C. Segar had introduced a bit player into his Thimble theater strip, Popeye the Sailor. Popeye quickly came to dominate the newspaper comic and through Fleischer cartoons became a pop culture icon. Music critic Milo Miles, who's a big animation fan, says the Fleischer Popeyes have finally been given their due on a new first-rate DVD set.
There have been many, many Popeyes since he first appeared in E.C. Seeger's Thimble Theater. I met Popeye, Olive Oil, Bluto and Company through television reruns of the Fleischer Brothers' 1930s cartoons. I didn't read Seeger's newspaper comics until I was an adult. They're absolutely wonderful, but very different. The Popeye closest to my heart is the Fleischer animated one. During a documentary about Segar's strip in the new DVD set, TV screenwriter Dan O'Shannon underscores what a long shot Popeye was.
Segar apparently created the character as this kind of one-off little side character in this one adventure, and then it just sort of hit with readers, and he moved center stage and essentially took over the comic strip. And I think that's how Popeye would have to become popular, as an accident. Because who in a room is going to sit down and go, I've got it. He's a sailor. He's about 40. Can't speak English very well. Missing an eye, no teeth. People are going to go, yes, people are going to love that. No, that's one of those things you have to find out by accident because no one could predict that kind of success for this character.
It's routine these days to note that Fleischer Studios used urban settings, vaudeville humor, and characters and objects that underwent surreal shape shifts. Also, that Popeye starred in the Depression era, if not as an everyman, as a working man, an ordinary guy with exceptional pluck and extraordinary spinach. I would argue that Popeye works as a figure from many folk tales. The trickster, the sly transformer who appears in many shapes to outwit his opponents. After all, Popeye is not just a sailor swab, but a sculptor, an engineer, a pilot, a professional dancer, and often a kind of Indiana Jones adventurer. But he was never an operator, a slick dude. No matter what his guise, this trickster sticks up for the little guy.
I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. Now just cause you're taller, don't hit someone smaller, says Popeye the Sailor Man.
Popeye the Sailor Volume 1 includes hours of additional features. Animation historians Jerry Beck and Michael Barrier, as well as director Greg Ford, provide the best commentaries. Film supplements include many pre-1930s cartoons associated with the Fleischers that are only of historical interest. But documentaries about Seeger's Thimble Theater and the earliest years of animation are superb. All the major characters get little bios, with Olive Oil faring best as the world's least likely sex symbol. But hey, she just starred in a commercial for Prego tomato sauce, so you gotta admit, she's aged well. A constant theme throughout the commentaries is how much the Fleischers' work focused on music and action rather than words and realism. Almost all the Popeye shorts are rough-and-tumble musicals with heaps of mindless violence thrown in. Perfect! Oddly enough, one of the most adroit musical passages belongs to Bluto as Sinbad the Sailor.
Oh, the most phenomenal, extra special kind of fellow. Sinbad the Sailor. I'm afraid of nobody under the sun. All I say is boo and my enemies run. Who's the most remarkable, extraordinary fellow?
It's Popeye the Sailor Man. Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm strong to the finish, cause I eat space spinach. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man.
Seymour Neidel probably animated more Popeye shorts than anyone else, and his best are certainly time capsule worthy. However, I would like to offer a personal salute to the leader of another animation unit, Willard Bowsky, whose Popeye cartoons are more visually clever, technically adroit, and outrageously funny than any others. As an adult animation fan, I took comfort that most of the classic cartoon animators were around to see their work revived and celebrated through television. But the first time I saw Willard Bowsky drawing, he was long gone. He had joined the Army in 1942 and was killed in action during the Battle of the Bulge. Of all the hands that helped create Popeye, I suspect he would be proudest of Bowsky.
I saw my duty and done it, cause I'm Popeye the Sailor Man.
On a consumer note, it's unfortunate that Popeye Volume 1 ends in 1938. It includes almost all the cartoons you need. There were a dozen or so snappy, hilarious shorts made after that date, equal to any earlier ones. But when the Fleischer brothers lost their studio to Paramount at the end of 1941, a notable decline in quality began to overtake the previously invincible Sailor. Few even entertaining Popeye cartoons were made after World War II. In the end, magical spinach was no match for the effects of time and change.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. The new four-disc DVD set, Popeye the Sailor, 1933 to 1938, is on Warner Home Video. If you'd like to catch up on interviews you've missed, you can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a search for 6 of the 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust. Daniel Mendelsohn, author of the book Lost, tells us about investigating what happened to his great-uncle's family in the Ukraine after they wrote letters to their relatives in the U.S. begging to help them flee. Join us for the next Fresh Air.